Good morning, gentlemen. It's great to see you, and congratulations for dragging yourself out. We have had one culprit who said the snow's too deep in his drive, but he does live in Chorley, and Chorley do get it about three times deeper than we do, so it's all of 3 inches in Chorley. Welcome, and you will be given medals on the way out. We were wondering which men would be brave enough to come this morning. We have been known to tackle virtually every subject, and we're about getting there now. The one I was thinking about was we've never really done men and politics. So I thought we'd do that this morning instead of women. Yeah, and we did try war and peace, but the padre who was going to do it, who has a master's in war and peace, he was then seconded to Germany, so he backed out of that one. But welcome, and thank you for coming. I want to introduce in a moment or two Patrick Keating. Patrick is a failed rock star, which is the reason he's the leader of one of our worship bands here, but he's also a gynecologist, and particularly works with ladies who have cancer. So that would formally make him an oncologist as well. How I talk about Patrick is that for many years he and I have met at his house for breakfast. Patrick always cooks, unless he's got up late, in which case he makes me cook. But I like to tell people that one of my prayer partners is an oncologist, and he makes me eggs for breakfast. Sorry, an obstetric. So anyway, great. I just want to share a little bit about kind of how the Bible begins to talk about women, and then I'm going to hand over to Patrick. In the beginning, God said, "Let us make mankind in our image." So in the image of God, he made them. Male and female, he created them. For God to make in his image, let us make mankind in our image. For God to make in his image, he makes male and female. For God to make in his image, who is, as we learn as we read the Bible, Father, Son, and Spirit, and one. For God to make in his image, he makes community, male and female. And that means that for God to make in his image, he makes equal. We live in this world where it's still ruled by guys, basically. But for God to make in his image, who is sometimes the big word used, indivisibly one, co-equal, Father, Son, and Spirit, who are one, for God to make in his image, he makes male and female, equally and one. So God said, it's not good that man should be alone. I'll make a helper suitable for him. So out of the ground, the Lord God formed animals and birds of every kind and brought them to the man to see what he would name them. And whatever he named them, that was what they were called. Still, no suitable helper was found for the man. So he caused the man to fall into a deep sleep, and from his side he took a rib, and with it he formed woman, and he brought her to the man. At last, the man said, "This is it. She will be called woman, for she was taken out of man. And for this reason, a man leaves his father and mother and comes to his wife in such a way that the two become one flesh." It's not good. Right through the creation story, you hear it's good, it's good, it's good, it's good. It's very good. And then in chapter 2, when you had that kind of almost fine detailed painted story, God looks at man on his own and goes, that's not good. I don't think it's because he's realised that a man on his own is a very dangerous thing. But I think it's more because there's this sense of to make in his image is to make community. So it's not good that man is alone, because he will suffer in aloneness unless he is in community. He will be more complete, more human, because he's in the community of a woman. And the two will become, in his image, one. The two will become one flesh. That little bit where the man wakes up, if you go and meditate on that, you could have a kind of a thousand wonderful fantasies. All biblical, all godly, hopefully. But imagine it. There is the man, he's fast asleep, and he wakes up and there's a lady in all her glory stood in front of him. And he's learnt what the names of all the animals are because he's had the privilege of naming them. But as he looks in front of her, of him, and sees this woman, he goes, man. This is how it works in Hebrew. And then he goes, no, it's not a man. And then he goes, wow, man. Woman. Literally in Hebrew, the word for man at that point is ish. And he goes, ish. Isha, and that's Hebrew for woman. So it does almost does the same as I've just done in English. And that's the real point I want to make at the end. We are, guys, lost without woman, because we're not complete with this person God has made to be equal with us in community. But then there's this incredible sense of wow. God has given us wow, man, woman. And never lose a sense of wow in a woman. Just a note of caution and danger about this morning. Whatever you do, woman is a mystery. Just because Patrick tells you a few things, don't you dare go home thinking you've got them sussed.
Right. I don't know about getting a medal for turning up this morning. I think you'll get a medal if you dare go home. The only person who deserves a medal for turning up this morning is me. I can't imagine why I agreed to give you this talk, but anyway. I know. It actually came out of a chat with Trevor over coffee, and He was asking me about my work, and I could see this look of complete misunderstanding and blankness appear across his face, and I suddenly thought, I wonder if this would be something interesting for the men's breakfast. So the story is, just to retell Andrew's story, it's actually that Adam was walking around the garden, and God said, what do you think of my creation, Adam? And he said, it's not bad. And God said, well, what's wrong? He said, well, actually, he said, I'm bored and I'm lonely. And God said, don't worry about this, Adam. I've got it fixed. I'm going to make you a companion. And Adam looked very skeptical about this. And God said, no, this companion is going to be fantastic. She's going to look wonderful all the time. She's going to just be absolutely beautiful. And Adam, of course, he didn't really believe all this. And then God said, and she's going to have your children for you, and she'll get up in the night and feed them, and you won't have to get up ever. You can sleep right through. And Adam was thinking, this is good. And then God said, yeah, and when you come back from a long day at work, she's going to sit you in front of the football and give you a beer and say, don't you worry, Adam, you just sit there, I'll make the tea. And Adam thought, wow, he said, this is fantastic. And then he said, hang on, there's got to be a catch. What's this going to cost me? And God said, well, it's going to cost you an arm and a leg, mate. So Adam said, well, what do I get for a rib? hang on. I'll turn it on. Right, so what is gynecology? Well, it's literally the science of woman. In fact, it's the treatment of diseases that affect the female reproductive system. So that's ovaries, fallopian tubes, vagina, vulva. In other countries, it includes breast surgery, breast treatment, but in the UK, that's never been the case. We have separate specialists for that. And it's the counterpart is andrology, which is doctors who treat the male reproductive system. Now, of course, it's not always been a subject that can openly be discussed. It's not even a subject that can you can easily approach. This is a drawing from 1822. We don't practice like this anymore, but this thing isn't working. I may need line of sight on the... There we go. Right, this is my sister, my little sister, Teresa, and she's an art dealer. She's working in Singapore at the moment. And many years ago, she lent me one of these. This is actually from ancient China. It's made of ivory, and it's a very detailed carving of a naked woman, because in ancient China, it wasn't permitted for a doctor or a man to examine a woman at all. And so when patients came to see their physician, they were handed one of these, and they would point to where the problem was, and that's how that was done. Where are the organs I'm talking about? I'm sure you know this. They're in the pelvis. They're housed within a bony protected area. And you can see there's the womb. It's a hollow structure, and it sits at the top of the vagina. And then on the side, you have fallopian tubes and ovaries right and left. That's a cross-sectional image. There are three openings, obviously, at the bottom. There's the urethra at the front, which is the passage for urine, the vagina in the middle, and the rectum or anus at the back. And so that's the area that we're concerned about. That's a photograph taken from a laparoscopic camera. So this is a camera that's gone in through the tummy button or the umbilicus, looking down onto the pelvis, and you can see in the middle there's the womb, and then slung either side, the tubes and the ovaries. At the bottom of the picture is some yellow fat, that's on the rectum, and in the front is the bladder, which is being held back by that little black probe up there. So are women just like us, but with different bits somewhere down there, as other specialists like to say? I get letters from the surgeon saying, would you please come and see this woman? I think there's something wrong, and it's somewhere down there, but I didn't like to look. Well, you've had talks on communication issues, you've had talks on the female brain, the female psychology, stress coping mechanisms. I'm not going to deal with all of that. We'd be here all day, and anyway, it's not really my field. I'm going to concentrate on the physical side of this, so I say that now in case you think that the talk is a little bit lopsided. But just to point out to you that the Greek word for the womb is hysteros, and we get hysterectomy from that, but we also get hysterical and hysteria, because the ancient medics believed that the emotions of a woman were held within the womb. And as you'll see, there is clearly links between the two. Right. Now, really to make sense of this, we've got to start with something called the menstrual cycle. This is something that we don't have, and this is fundamental to understanding women, because women have hormones, as we do, but those hormones will vary in levels in the blood throughout the month. This is controlled largely by the brain, a little gland at the base of the brain, at the top of the picture there, called the hypothalamus. That produces two hormones, FSH and LH, and the first graph shows you how the levels of those will vary throughout the month. The particular peak occurring in the middle of the month. Now, by the month, I'm talking about the menstrual month, so that's a four-week cycle for most women. And we start the clock the day bleeding starts. That's just the way we do it. So the left of the graph is the first day of bleeding. Bleeding is usually complete within 1 week. And the line down the middle is the middle part of the cycle, so that would be day 14. And that's the day, as you can see in the second diagram, more or less when ovulation will take place. So ovulation takes place round about day 14, give or take a day or two, providing a woman's having a 28-day cycle. And ovulation is something that's going on in the ovaries, being driven by the hormones in the blood that have come from the brain. And in turn, the ovaries then produce a new set of hormones, which you'll be familiar with, I guess, estrogen and progesterone. And those are in the graph second from the bottom. And you can see that the levels of those hormones also is going up and down constantly throughout the month. And one of the effects they have is on the lining of the womb. And the drawing at the bottom is the lining of the womb. And the idea is that the lining of the womb is thickening up. And around about day 14, it's ready for implantation of a fertilized egg, if there is one. If there isn't, then about 2 weeks later, that lining collapses and comes away as blood, which we call the period, and then it all starts again. But the point I really wanted to make, I didn't want to get into too much detail, was that hormone levels are going up and down throughout the month. I can't get this thing to... There we go. Right, so I thought I'd get straight into the one that everyone's been talking about, or at least they have been muttering in my ear about this one, which is the premenstrual syndrome, or premenstrual tension, because this is obviously the subject of a lot of jokes amongst guys. So what's the truth? Is there any? This is being recorded, isn't it? I'll leave it for you to tell everybody what you were laughing at. All right. Okay. Now, the body has largely two ways of communicating with itself. We've got the nervous system, which is essentially an electrical wiring system, which gives messages fairly quickly, in fact, very quickly. But then we have the hormone system, which is a chemical system, and that's basically giving messages to the whole of the body, but in a much slower way. And the sorts of things that hormones control are listed here. And depending on which hormone it is, the effects can be very, very varied indeed. And people often say, oh, you know, hormones, they're bad, aren't they? You don't want to take hormones. Well, actually, you do. You need them. Like most things, if you take them at the wrong time or in too great a quantity, then there may be effects you don't want. But hormones are essential for health. And there's a list there of some of the things that they will control. Growth, levels of sugar, hunger craving, and so on. And also, of course, the menstrual cycle. Now, again, this is just to remind you that hormone levels in the bottom there are going up and down all the time. Now, you might think, well, still I understand why you get premenstrual syndrome, because, you know, these estrogen and progesterone levels, which are going up and down, it's all about ovulation, it's all about reproduction. Well, it isn't, actually. The actions of these hormones are surprising, I think. They do play a role in the formation of secondary sexual characteristics, so breast growth and so on. They also accelerate height growth, reduce muscle mass, and they stimulate growth of the womb, and they stimulate the growth of the womb lining, which is called the endometrium. And they will retain fluid and salt. But surprisingly, estrogen also maintains blood vessels, it reduces bone loss, it increases bone formation, increases blood clotting factors, increases platelet stickiness, reduces bowel motility, increases melanin, which is to do with the pigmentation of your skin, promotes lung function, and maintains growth of hormone-sensitive cancers. Some tissues in the body have a high number of estrogen receptors, and the presence of estrogen will cause those cells to grow more actively, and that particularly applies to the womb and to the breast. And progesterone, similarly, has effects on the reproductive system. It's involved with inhibition of labor throughout the pregnancy until the end. But oddly, it improves airway flow in the lung, it regulates the lung mucus, reduces gallbladder activity, normalizes blood clotting, normalizes the use of fat stores, and helps maintain resilience in bone, teeth, gums, tendon, and skin. It also counteracts the effects of estrogen on the womb, and therefore prevents the womb becoming cancerous. So, armed with that list of
widespread effects, you shouldn't really be surprised that if you go and interview 300 girls at university and ask them if they get symptoms in the week leading up to their periods, you find that they do. And in fact, in quite high numbers, 68% had changes in appetite, 65% experienced irritability, 65% had swelling, 47% had fatigue, 61% had pain, 50% had feelings of depression, 40% had changes in sleeping habits, 34% had depressive thoughts, and 18% had anxiety. So it's a real phenomena. And there are some factors which make a particular girl more likely to experience significant premenstrual syndrome than others. The point at which these symptoms become a problem is difficult. There are scoring systems to understand that, but all of us have feelings of anxiety and all of us have change in sleep from time to time. But these are problems which are beginning to affect their ability to function. And in fact, tests done a long time ago showed that if you look at the phase of the menstrual cycle of girls undergoing mathematics exams, you can show that they will perform less well, statistically significantly, in the week leading up to their period. So these are real effects. Now, two people I've treated stick in my mind. One was a woman who came eventually to me because of aggressive behavior. And initially, I went on a search for a tumor that was producing testosterone and causing excessive male-type aggressive behavior. But none was found. And as the weeks went by and I got her to keep a diary, it emerged that actually this was not constant. It had a cyclical pattern to it, and that the behavior was really occurring in the week or 10 days before her period. It was so bad that if this couple happened to be on holiday during the week leading up to her period, staying in a hotel, he slept on the beach because he was being beaten up. Eventually, after a host of attempts with various drug treatments, it was decided just to remove the womb and ovary surgically and take out the source of the varying hormone levels, and then put back by oral medication hormone replacement, which is done at a steady state, so the same dose every day. And she phoned me up about 8 weeks past surgery. I never forget this. She said, I've been back to work, and all these people who haven't spoken to me for about 3 years have come to say hi. It's nice to have you back. And it was all down to premenstrual syndrome. The other woman was getting arrested once a month. And when I spoke to the police in Lytham and asked for sight of the arresting officer's log, it mapped her menstrual cycle. And again, it resulted in surgery. It's not usually necessary to be that drastic. It's unusual to have to operate on somebody because of premenstrual syndrome. But as I say, those two stick in my mind. So yes, it is a real thing. Now, most of the time, treatment can be along these lines. There's no magic fix here. There's no Harry Potter wand for this condition. Education, including education of partners, which I hope this morning will contribute towards. Nutrition, reducing caffeine, salt, sugar. These are chemicals that will give the brain a bit of a hit and a bit of a boost, particularly refined sugars will do this. The problem is that once the food is out of the system, there's quite a drop afterwards, and so you get fluctuating moods, which will just be, which will just make this even worse. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists recommends complex carbohydrates. These are generally cereal-type foods, which the body takes time to metabolize. You get much slower rise in blood sugar levels, which are sustained over a long period of time. Exercise is recommended, and then occasionally we resort to medication. And the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, things like Brufen, which will be familiar to most people, they will deal with pain, cramps, wound cramps. Diuretics are water tablets. You saw that estrogen causes salt and water retention, so occasionally a diuretic will reduce painful swelling of the breast or leg that may be going on. Antidepressants may play a role, and you'd think that hormone treatment would be a good idea because the whole thing seems to be rooted in hormones. In fact, the research has never shown that it's convincingly useful to do that, which is a little bit strange, but there you have it. Okay, so sexual response, not going to dwell on this for long, but again, sexual desire will vary at different times of the month, and after what we've just seen, that shouldn't be a surprise. Fertility is really maximum around day 14. The egg is not very good at hanging around. It lasts about 12 to 24 hours. So once ovulation has occurred, there's only a window of about another day during which the woman is able to become pregnant. But sperm, on the other hand, are much more resilient, and they'll hang around for 4 or 5 days. So intercourse that takes place approximately 4 days prior to ovulation might result in pregnancy in that particular cycle. But again, we do have couples who come to the fertility clinic where they only actually see each other once a month because he works away. And when you ask, it's not that time of the month, and they're wondering why they're not getting pregnant. So I'll put that in there. Women have a much slower arousal rate than men. It's said to take up to 40 minutes. You might like to think about that. They also get a more prolonged response. If this was a study that looked at women's desire to make love, and you can see the luteal phase, that's the second half of the cycle, in other words, after ovulation has occurred and the egg is now gone, only 1 in 12 tested indicated a desire to make love, whereas the follicular phase, which is the phase leading up to ovulation, when the womb is preparing itself for pregnancy should that occur, got a much higher desire amongst women, and that's probably hormonally driven also. Might like to bear that in mind. There you go. Honestly, dear, I really do have a headache tonight. And that's just showing the different sexual response between men and women. Men generally have a steeper takeoff. We're aroused much more quickly. We will tend to peak more early, and once we do, it all goes quiet again. Whereas for women, the response can be a lot more sustained. And I'll leave it to your imagination. This hit song by Chris de Burgh, Lady in Red, was claimed to be the song most commonly made love during. Apparently that was said on a TV show, to which Phil Collins said, "Really? So what do they do for the other 2 minutes?" He obviously hadn't seen that graph. Okay, so really the bread and butter of gynecology is here. As Andrew said, I'm mostly involved with the treatment of cancer, but general gynecology deals with a lot of this. Now, heavy periods are defined as a blood loss of more than 80 mils of blood per month. This is an extremely unhelpful definition because nobody measures blood loss per month. In fact, somebody did. Believe it or not, they handed out clean tampons that they'd weighed, and then they collected the dirty ones and they weighed those. You've got to then work out what the drying factor is, and you can come up with an amount of blood. A friend of mine actually did this research project. I can't believe he stuck it for 2 years, but he did. The point about 80 mils of blood is that once a woman's losing more than 80 mils of blood, then her body is not going to keep up with the loss of blood and iron, and she will become anemic. So the definition is helpful in that sense. But the reality is, if a woman says her periods are heavy, then we try to treat it, because if she says it's heavy, it's heavy. And for some women, heavy periods really are a problem. Sorts of questions we would ask to get an angle on how much of a problem it would be. would be, have you ever had to buy a new mattress? Yes. Have you ever stood at the supermarket and found yourself in a pool of blood? Yes. Do you find blood soaked through to the car seat? Yes. Do you have to sleep with a towel wrapped around you at night? Oh, yes. Three, actually. So you can imagine that for some people this is quite a problem. Periods, of course, can be very painful. I think most periods are uncomfortable, but some are very painful to the point that woman actually has to go to bed once or twice each month for one or two days. Some women are taking two or three days off work. We treated somebody just 2 weeks ago who's having 3 days every month off work just because of the pain of her periods. Not for long, I hope. And there are a number of causes for these problems. The first one I want to talk about is endometriosis. Briefly, the lining of the womb, as you see on the right there, is labeled, is called endometrium. And the endometrium, as you remember from the graph, thickens up every month under the control of hormones that are coming through the bloodstream. And then if no pregnancy occurs, it bleeds away. And that's the period. Now, the problem with endometriosis is you get cells exactly like the lining of the womb, but not in the womb. They're situated in other places, outside the womb, on the ovaries, down by the rectum. And they, of course, will also respond to the hormone levels going around the bloodstream and thicken up, and then if no pregnancy occurs, they will bleed. Now, you don't get massive internal hemorrhage from this, but you do get microscopic bleeding into the tissues, which hurts a lot. This is the picture I showed you earlier of a normal-looking pelvis, and just down here, I don't think I can do this now, okay. Does that have a laser on it, this thing? Ah, there we go. So there's the womb, and these are the ovaries, and then these two ligaments here, called the uterus sacral ligaments, they hold the bottom part of the uterus in place, and then the rectum is here, and this area here is just a hollow space between the two. It's actually called the pouch of Douglas. And these shouldn't be here. These are little blood blisters. And that's endometriosis. So every month, this area behind the womb is getting very angry and inflamed. And the effects of that will be that any movement of this area will hurt. So examinations by doctors hurt. But intercourse hurts. And going to the toilet hurts. And eventually, the inflammation that this sets up will cause things to start to become adherent and stuck together until, in the end, the whole thing is just a big fibrotic, stuck mass of very uncomfortable painfulness. These are actually called powder burn spots. They were named after the black marks that men got in the side of their faces when they fired a flintlock rifle, because a flintlock rifle shoots carbon into the side of your face, and it was thought to look a bit like that, which is why soldiers grew their hair down here and called them side burns. So there you go. So those are called powder burn spots, and that's typical of endometriosis. Now, endometriosis can occur in a variety of places. In this case, the endometriosis was inside the ovary, so there was menstruation going on inside the ovary every month. And over a period of many months, that blood has accumulated, and you can see the ovary has swollen right up here into the cystic structure. Now, because the blood is old, it takes on a dark brown appearance, and so that gets the name a chocolate cyst. Pathologists like to name things after food. We've never understood why they do that, but they do. And these are called chocolate cysts. So that's again, a problem associated with endometriosis. This is the womb here that's been cut open in this diagram. Thanks. Now, the symptoms of endometriosis will largely depend on the site, and I've shown you the most common site, which is down behind the back of the womb, and that will cause pain there. But the odd thing about endometriosis is it's been described pretty much anywhere in the body. It can be found in the bowel, which means that she'll suffer from rectal bleeding once a month. It's been found in the bladder, so there's blood in the urine once a month. It crops up in wounds, particularly wounds that are caused around the time of pregnancy. So cesarean section scars or episiotomy scars will develop painful blood-filled swellings. It's also been described in the nose, so women would get a monthly nosebleed at the same time they're menstruating. I've seen one patient who had it in the lung, so she was coughing up blood once a month until her ovaries were removed to stop the whole thing. And pretty much anywhere else. I'm not aware that it's ever been described in the brain, but I might be wrong about that. Okay, so another cause of heavy or painful periods are fibroids. Fibroids are tumors. They're benign tumors. They're basically lumps of muscular gristle, and they will occur almost anywhere in the body, but they're most commonly found in women, and they're most commonly found in the womb. In fact, it's estimated that 50% of women aged 50 have fibroids. Most of those don't know, don't need to know, because they're not causing any particular problems. And they can be situated in various places, in the wall of the womb, down by the cervix, and of course, depending on where they are, will affect what they do. This one, for example, might obstruct labor and mean that the birth had to be by cesarean. These ones here would tend to cause problems with periods, irregular bleeding, that sort of thing. That's what they actually look like. It's not a very good picture. It's not one of mine, I'm afraid. But sometimes fibroids grow very, very large. I mean, there's a surgeon's hand there. This is all, there's the ovary. That's fairly normal looking. That's probably the womb about there. And all the rest of that is fibroids. The largest I've removed weighed 17 pounds. It was just huge. Pelvic infection is another potent cause of pain. Infection causes swelling of tubes. This tube is swollen up, filled with fluid. It causes adhesions, causes things to be stuck together, get angry, and occasionally we need to operate on this. There we go. That's what that looks like. So that's a real picture of the drawing you've just seen. This is the back of the uterus covered in exudate adhesions from other structures. This is the fallopian tube on the left, very swollen, very distended, very angry, and again, very painful. So the treatment for heavy periods will vary. It can often be treated with drugs like mefenamic acid as a brufen-like drug. It's sometimes treated with a coil that has a hormone on it called the Mirena. It's sometimes treated by a minor operation done as a day case, which basically cauterizes the lining of the womb, or it's sometimes treated by removal of the womb. Other things may require other treatments also. That's just the spectrum of things for that. Thought I'd just put this one in. This actually came from a lecture given to some medical students. We don't have to deal with trauma too much, I'm glad to say. But occasionally we do. Bicycle crossbars are one of the main culprits for tears and bruises that need surgical intervention. But I did see a three-year-old girl who'd managed to fall over a porcelain vase that was by the fireplace, which then splintered into shards, and one of them did exactly what that's doing in the drawing, which took quite a bit of care to put that back together. Other causes of trauma, obviously assault or bizarre behavior. But just to point out that the vagina is an organ that's very moist and it's also very stretchy. And it's designed that way largely for childbirth because it needs to stretch from, about an inch across to the diameter of a baby's head. But in a postmenopausal woman where estrogen levels are low, the vagina loses all those characteristics. It becomes a much less stretchy piece of skin, and lubrication or moisture is not as effective. And we do occasionally see women brought in through accident and emergency who have been having normal consensual intercourse with their partner, and it's resulted in tears that are severe enough to cause 1, 2, or even 3 pints of blood loss. Not commonly, but how are we doing for time? It's a bit of a whistle whistle stop tour, this. Urinary incontinence, this is another common problem dealt with in gynecology clinics. It's extremely common, more than you might imagine. Urinary incontinence, or loss of urine, defined by occurring at least once in the previous 12 months, has been estimated to be present in 69% of women, 39% of men. In general, it's thought to be twice as common in women as it is in men. And the prevalence, again, will increase with age. So it's estimated that over the age of 80, 46% of women and 34% of men will have urinary incontinence. There are a number of causes of urinary incontinence, but the most common fall into two groups, which are stress incontinence or urge incontinence. Now, stress incontinence means stress or pressure on the bladder that the bladder is unable to hold on to. So that would typically be a cough or a laugh or jumping down some steps. And the added pressure on the bladder causes a leak of urine. And that's generally due to weakness of the muscles of the pelvic floor. And then there's urge incontinence, which is a problem with the muscle of the bladder that just takes it upon itself to contract at a time when it is not convenient and not desired. The bladder is basically an organ that, left to its own devices, would fill and then just empty. What the brain does is inhibits all of that, so that the wiring, if you like, is to stop the bladder from working. And if something goes wrong with that at any point in the system, then the person loses the control of passing urine and they'll get an urge to go. They might dash for the loo, they might make it on time, or they might find that they don't. Obviously, these are not life-threatening problems, but they're very socially disabling. The main cause of the first one, the stress incontinence, is thought to be this. This is childbirth. You can see it's extraordinary that anybody gets born, frankly. The size of that head coming through that passageway, but it does. But it wouldn't surprise you to think that things are going to get stretched, ligaments are going to get torn. If you imagine a rubber band that's been over-pulled, it just won't ever go back to the way it should be. And the same sort of process is going on here. If the birth is very prolonged and the head is sat on the structures for a long period of time, it's thought that the effects of reducing the blood supply to muscles and nerves causes a permanent damage also, which is one of the reasons why in modern obstetrics, labours are not allowed, or at least the second part of labour, the pushing part, are not allowed to go on and on and on. But generally, people will intervene if things have got past half an hour to an hour, and it's all around an attempt to prevent damage to the pelvic floor with subsequent either prolapse or urinary problems. The thing about incontinence is that what the studies have shown is that relatively few people who suffer from it come forward to see a doctor. And if they did, for most of them, it would be treatable. And the sorts of treatments that are required for stress incontinence are often quite simple things. Often physiotherapy, a course of pelvic floor exercises, will restore the tone that's required. Pelvic ferritism is basically electric shock treatment. The pelvic floor is stimulated in order to increase the tone of the muscles. And then there's a host of surgical operations for this condition, many of which are simple procedures done as day cases, some of which are a bit more involved. Treatments for urge incontinence tend not to be surgical. Again, rely on physiotherapy, biofeedback techniques, or drug treatment. In very severe cases, where control of the bladder just can't be maintained at all, surgeons will take the bladder out and make a bag so that the urine is then diverted into a stoma and the individual can basically go about their normal life without constantly being wet and smelling of urine. I met somebody last week who'd had that done about 6 months ago. Okay, how are we doing? Any questions? No one's got up and left, anyway. I'm going to talk now about the menopause, hormone replacement therapy. What is the menopause? Is it a recent thing? This is quite interesting. This is life expectancy at birth. We haven't been living very long for very long. And in fact, for most of history, there hasn't really been a menopause because no one's lived that long. I wouldn't say nobody. If you did get to 15 years old, here we are in medieval, if you got to the age of 21 in medieval Britain, then that meant you'd survived infectious disease, possibly childhood trauma, and therefore your life expectancy was actually 43. An additional 43, so total years of 64. So there were people going into the menopause at these times, but for most folk, they just didn't live that long. So it is a relatively recent phenomena, which is interesting when you talk about natural treatments, because what is natural? You know, is it natural to actually not live that long? The word menopause literally means meno month, pause, stop. In other words, it's defined by the cessation of menstrual bleeding. In fact, it's not quite that. It's ovarian failure. Women are born with about 1 million eggs per ovary. They don't use all of those up. Not all of them will ever fire up and be ovulated. And around about the age of 51 in this country, with a range of 45 to 55, periods will stop. Now, as I say, it's ovarian failure that's occurring. The womb is responding to the hormones that the ovaries make, and therefore periods will stop. So that's the clue. If a woman's had a hysterectomy but still has ovaries, then technically she's not menopausal until those ovaries stop working, even though she's not having periods. Now, the menopause is one of those points in time that you don't know when it is until you look back. So you can't say that the period this month is going to be the last one and therefore the individual is menopausal. All you can say is, well, there hasn't been a period for the last 6 months, therefore this person must be menopausal. But the Greeks had another word for this called the climacteric. Now, the climacteric means a ladder, because they recognized that this whole business of menopause wasn't a sudden switch off, but there was a steady run up to it, and that's why they named it after a ladder. And for anything up to 10 years before the menopause, women will start to experience some of the symptoms that we associate with the menopause. And that's because the ovaries are beginning to fail intermittently. They fail a little bit like a light bulb that flickers on and flickers off and continues to work for a while. So they may get hot flush. They may get hot flushes, for example, for some months and then not. It's quite variable. Now, as I've already said to you, people think hormones are bad for you, and particularly when it comes to HRT, people seem very wary of taking hormones. But in fact, as this picture shows, hormones are at work throughout all of your body, and you may know most of these. Your thyroid gland keeps your metabolic rate going. If that becomes underactive, you stop burning up fuel, you feel the cold, you start to put on weight because you're not burning up fuel, your reflexes become slow, etc. If your pancreas fails, you become diabetic because you can't produce the insulin that's required to regulate blood sugars. If your adrenal glands fail, you lose the stress response. You can't produce steroids in response to stress or exercise or fear, and so on. So these are all hormonally controlled events. And here's examples of hormones throughout the body. Thyroxine, as I've said, metabolic rate, parathyroid, calcium in bone, and so forth. Testosterone, I think we all know about that one. Now, just with as with premenstrual tension, some of the symptoms that occur when the ovaries fail and the levels of estrogen and progesterone drop right down are surprising. And here's a list. Women will commonly get hot flushes. These come unexpectedly. They suddenly feel hot. They may go red. And they occur during sleep, which interferes with sleep and causes tiredness and irritability. They may get muscle cramps. They may get joint aches. They quite often get loss of libido. They say that some women get an increase in libido when they go through the menopause. I've yet to meet one. professionally, I mean. vaginal dryness and pain, itching or discomfort during sex, that's around the vaginal skin not responding any longer to arousal process, not being able to be moist, not being able to be compliant or elastic, which I've mentioned already. They may experience palpitations, they may get headaches, they may get mood changes such as depression, anxiety, tiredness. There may be sleep problems, as I've said, often related to night sweats. And there's an increased tendency for urinary tract infections, or even the sensation of a urinary tract infection without an infection actually being there. Most women are going to get some of these. They may not get all of them, but most women are going to get some of those. What's also going on in the background is that they're starting to lose bone. Now, as we grow older, we all start to lose bone, and some of us will get osteoporosis, which is a thinning and a weakening of the bone, which means that if you fall, it's more likely you will break a bone than when you were younger. There are other things which will increase your risk of osteoporosis, such as never having done much exercise, not eating foods rich in calcium, and smoking. The interesting thing about osteoporosis in women is that, again, people don't always view it as a dangerous entity. But the reality is, if you're 70-something and you fall and break your hip, about a third of people never leave hospital, all right? Because their bones can't be put back together, they die of hospital-acquired infections, they used to get bed sores, I trust that doesn't happen anymore. So in fact, this is quite a serious issue, and that is partly why hormone replacement therapy and other drug treatments have been so researched and talked about. So hormone replacement therapy has some benefits because not only will it deal with the symptoms of the menopause, which I've listed, but it also has this long-term benefit of reducing the loss of bone and therefore reducing fracture. And studies have shown that you can not only measure using x-rays bone density and show that hormone replacement therapy maintains bone density, but you can actually show that people get less fractures, and you can also show that there are less deaths associated with osteoporosis in women who take HRT. The problem is, of course, there are risks, and this is where people start to say that they don't want to take hormones. There is a risk of blood clots. It's a very small risk, but it is there. And blood clots which form in the leg are very uncomfortable, but blood clots that form in the lung can be fatal, and can be fatal instantly. So whilst not common, if it occurs, it can be quite serious. The cancer risk is one, I think, that gets misunderstood and overemphasized, because it's not true to say that if you have hormone replacement therapy, you will get cancer. It just increases your risk. To put that in perspective, if you took 1,000 women who did not have hormone replacement therapy and were over 50, and you waited to see what happened to them, about 75 of them would get breast cancer. If you took another 1,000 women over the age of 50 and you gave all of them hormone replacement therapy for 5 years, about 79 of them would get breast cancer. So yes, there are 4 extra breast cancers on top of the 75 that nature served up. And you can show if your study's large enough, and the study was, it had 50,000 women in it, you can show that that's mathematically significant. But whether it really is biologically significant, set against not having treatment for sleeplessness, mood effects, inability to hold down a job, is arguable, I think. There are some alternatives for women who choose not to take estrogen, progesterone replacement, or women who can't take it, either because they have problems with things like thrombosis, or because they've got a cancer which is hormone sensitive. There are estrogen-like compounds in some plants, and though I'm not a herbalist, there are herbalists in town who can advise on this, but some plants such as red leaf clover, black cohosh, St. John's wort, have chemicals in them called isoflavones, which have some estrogen-like activity in the human body and will go some way to treating some of these symptoms. And there are some non-hormonal drug treatments, for example, treatments of mood and so forth. Okay, so I'm just going to finish off then a little bit on some of the cancers that affect women. This is really my field, but I wasn't going to dwell on this too long. Cervix cancer first. It was back in 1842 that an Italian doctor noticed two things. He noticed that nuns didn't tend to get cervix cancer and were more prone to breast cancer, and he put that down to their corsets being too tight. But he also noticed that cervix cancer was quite common amongst prostitutes, and he wondered whether there was some factor that was being passed on during intercourse. And of course, we now know that there is, and it's called human papillomavirus. This is a normal-looking cervix, so this is a gynecologist view, I'm afraid, of a woman. And this is looking up the vagina at the bottom end of the womb, and you can see the opening here, which we call the cervical os, going up inside the womb. And then this is the normal-looking cervix here. This, I'm afraid, isn't normal. It's got an overgrowth of white, irregular tissue. It's fissured, it's bleeding. It's lost its sort of sense of architecture, shape about it, and that is a cervical cancer. And this is the virus that causes the majority, probably not all, without question, not all, but the majority of these problems. This is a virus called HPV, human papillomavirus. It's a DNA virus. It looks like that. Now then, how do you protect your daughters from that? I suppose the question really is, how do you protect your daughters from that most vile thing, boys? Well, one way is that you get your girls doing all kinds of interesting things that intimidates boys. Right? Because boys like to think they're better at certain stuff, so make sure your girls are better than them. Because eventually, the boys at school start talking about your daughters, which is a complete outrage. And there should be a law against it, but there isn't, which is why fathers have to take matters into their own hands. And what the boys at school say is, yeah, that Becky and Lizzie, they are well cool. And what you hope their friends say is, forget it, mate, they're well out of your league. But really, if you want to protect them, you need to be thinking about this. This is now the first ever vaccine to prevent cancer that's been made. And this is one of the brands. This is the one that the UK now offers to all teenage girls. It's two injections, and it's available through the GP. And this vaccine is active against two viral types that cause cervical cancer, HPV 16 and 18, but because of something known as immunological cross-reactivity, it'll actually work against other viruses that it wasn't designed to. It's now effectively preventing 80% of HPV infections from becoming persistent. Now, it's too early to see whether that's going to reduce the number of cervical cancers, but it's extremely likely that it is. At the moment, there's just under 1,000 women a year dying from cervical cancer in the UK. So with luck, that will come down to around 200 if this vaccination program continues and is as successful as it seems to be. It's not available for older women, but I think some GPs are giving it privately, and there are some people who may benefit from that. This is vulval cancer. The next few pictures are a bit unpleasant, so if you're struggling with some of this, look away now. This is an ulcerating lesion on the right labia majora. There's actually a skin condition in the background here called lichen sclerosis, and this is also an abnormal area here. This cancer is also often associated with HPV, so the virus seems to be able to cause malignant change in cells, not only of the neck of the womb, but also of the vulva as well. It incidentally also causes changes in the vaginal skin and the perianal skin, so the whole sort of area down there can be affected by this type of tumour. Some of the surgery for this, because of where it is really very difficult. This is another tumour here, and to get this clear, all of the skin has to be removed. And this is somebody who had treatment about 8 years ago now for this sort of thing. So there's the anal opening there, there's the vaginal and urethral opening there, and all of that has had to be taken off. Now, you can't pull that bit of skin over to that bit of skin and get it to close, and so what you have to do is find a friendly plastic surgeon who marks out skin flaps on the inside of the thigh and buttocks, identifies the blood supply to those using a Doppler, and then dissect around here and lift the whole flap and bring it medially. Now, this is called a V to Y flap, because it starts as a V incision, but as you're about to see, once the skin has been brought across to the middle so that it joins, you're left with a tail end of wound, which you then close, and you end up with a Y shape. So that was what that looked like at the end of that particular operation, and that's what it looked like 2 weeks later. As I say, this was 8 years ago. This individual is very well, goes skiing every year. And then vaginal cancer, again, is a very rare condition, probably also caused by HPV. Most vaginal cancers are treated with lasers or chemotherapy, radiotherapy, but occasionally surgery is required. This individual, I didn't get photographs of this, so I just drew you the picture just to give you an idea of what we do, because this individual had disease for the whole of the vagina, which therefore had to be removed. She was 38 at the time, and I gave her the option of having a vagina remade in order to maintain her intimate relationship with her husband. We hadn't done one of these before, so I phoned up a chap in Sheffield called Tim Terry, who does gender reassignment surgery. Which is all very bizarre, and I don't know a lot about it, but I rang him up. I said, I really could do with your technical help here, because I have a young woman who needs to have the whole of the vagina removed, and I can't bear to just do that and close up the hole. Can we build something new? So he came up, and what we did with one of the colorectal surgeons is we took out the whole vagina, and then we took a piece of sigmoid colon here, and we divided it there and there, but we maintained the blood supply to that piece of bowel. We then took that piece of bowel and put it here, left one end open, stitched it to the inside of the vulval lips, and closed up the other end, and then closed up the bowel over it. So we ended up with this. You can see a piece of bowel down here. This probably sounds a bit gross, but actually the bowel's about the right diameter. It makes its own mucus, so it really is quite good for the job. From the external point of view, you wouldn't know, because you wouldn't know. You couldn't see anything different. And as I say, this was about 10 years ago now, and I don't see this individual any longer. She's very well. And then finally, ovarian cancer. This is a cross-sectional image to the pelvis. It's an MRI scan. This is the pelvic bone here. This is the spine at the back. And this shouldn't be here. Now, the ovaries are actually capable of making a lot of cyst types, and not all of them are cancerous. One of the commonest cysts is something called a dermoid cyst. This is the commonest cyst we remove in young women. And the odd thing about dermoid cysts is they're derived from the cells that still have all the genetic material switched on and working to make a baby. And so they are capable of making all kinds of tissue. And you can see in this ovarian cyst, you've got some teeth, you've got some bone, you've got some hair up here, you've got skin. You can pretty much find anything. You can find brain tissue. You can even get functioning glandular tissue, such as thyroid tissue, in an ovarian cyst. And a woman can turn up with what looks like an overactive thyroid when actually it's a tumor in the ovary. But some cysts, I'm afraid, look like this. This is a big cyst. This is the incision through the abdomen in the back. And this is a huge malignant ovarian cyst that's being removed there. So that's a whistle-stop tour of gynecology. Andrew and I didn't actually discuss the content of our talks, but we seem to have picked up on a very similar point. Except mine's been blotted out. Can you just move that box? Just move it down a bit if you want. Yeah, so if you're looking at Genesis, the Lord God said, "It is not good for the man to be alone. I will make a helper suitable for him." And then in Ephesians, Paul says, "Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her." So I hope this morning has perhaps given you some insight that you may not have had as to the strange workings of that creature we call woman. And it might assist you in being a little bit more understanding, perhaps. There's just a short clip, if it'll run. And then I'll take any questions if you want.
She can kill with her smile, she can wound with her eyes, and she can ruin your faith with her casual lies, and she only reveals what she wants you to see.